Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the next episode of the podcast. This time, I'm introducing you to someone who's known in the industry as Jim Carrey with a PhD. His name is Dr. Danny Rossell, and he's spoken to over 3,500 audiences worldwide, as well as written numerous books. He's a highly sought-after speaker, trainer, and coach, and is the co-founder of the Well-Crafted Story Workshop. He tells lots of stories this week. As you can tell, obviously, he is a storyteller, but it's the two stories of magic, of mystery, that he shares in this episode that really captured me. So without further ado, here's my interview with the delightful Dr. Danny.
The real estate scam really was a great thing to happen to me, Kirsten. It really humbled me because it made me have to ask a lot of other people for help. That was a very important, it was very sobering to me.
I'd love for you to introduce yourself. Who are you?
Perfect.
Go for it.
Well, first of all, Kirsten, thank you so much for having me on your show. I love it. We need more people like you spreading joy in the world. In terms of who the heck am I, if I was going to write an autobiography, it would be called Pivots, because I feel like I've already lived nine lives. 30 years ago, I was a journalist covering President Bush Sr. in the 1992 presidential election. I loved it. I had a great job. Got to meet every editor of every major daily, and one editor offered me the city beat for $16,500 a year. Meanwhile, a friend told me they were hiring teachers in South Central Los Angeles for $25,000 a year. So I became an educator for the noblest of reasons, Kirsten, for the high pay. And I actually fell in love with teaching. I've taught all age levels, from preschoolers all the way up to rocket scientists. I can make that claim because I used to teach English as a second language to engineering students at the University of Southern California. And in 2005, my wife and I attended a real estate seminar, which turned out to be a scam, and we lost everything financially. And I could give you the woe is me story, but I'm a positive person. I learned a lot from the experience. First of all, I learned that my wife is my soulmate. I put her through the ringer and she stood right by me. She's an incredible human being. Second of all, I learned that money's not everything, because you can lose money just like that. Third, Kirsten, I try not to judge other people anymore, because if I was somebody who saw what I had done, I would have said, well, you deserve that. But now I realize, unless you know everything about a person, you really don't know anything about a person. Fourth, I became a Christian, which I'm always embarrassed to confess. It took a catastrophe. But the more I read my Bible, I realize I ain't the first screw up to find Jesus. And then fifth, I didn't want to file for bankruptcy, and my accountant said, well, you have to earn this much more money this year. And so I started speaking on the side, and I hit that number right on the number. Well, the next year, Kirsten, he gave me a much higher number, and I hit that number right on the number. So in year three, I thought, well, maybe I should set a higher number. And basically, during one of the worst economic downturns in American history, I was able to build up a highly lucrative speaking business, which eventually attracted the attention of some pretty famous people and companies who asked me to coach them. And I have to admit, I really resisted coaching for a long time, because you need to know this about me. I'm obsessive compulsive. I will not let you fail. I will be on your back, holding you accountable until you succeed. Well, now that I work primarily with business owners and entrepreneurs and executives, I find that they're highly motivated. They do the work, and it's been some of the most rewarding work I've ever done. So you can take me down whichever path you choose, my friend.
Oh my gosh, I was just gonna say, speaking is terrifying. Did you ever feel terrified? Because for me, you know, I have a master's of divinity, and I took a sermon class, and I hate being up in front of people. I hate being seen. I hate all of it. And, you know, the few times I had to get up at, you know, the UU church or whatever, my heart was having arrhythmia. I couldn't breathe. Were you ever scared?
I've never met a microphone I didn't like, but I will say this. I was speaking to schools in India in 2018, and I got all the kids pumped up at a school, and afterwards they all come up, hey, you're great and everything. And then I look down, there's this little boy, he's got tears in his eyes. He's about 6 years old, and I notice he's missing his left arm. And he looks up at me, he's like, how can I succeed? And so I crouched down to his eye level. I'm like, you know, when I was your age, I went to 18 different schools before I was 12 years old. Everybody called me stupid because I stuttered. And eventually I went to a school where a teacher worked one-on-one with me, and she would sing things to me, and I found I could sing them back without my stutter. It's kind of like the movie The King's Speech. And eventually I lost my stutter and I became a swan. But I looked at that boy in the eyes. I'm like, isn't it interesting? The little boy everybody used to make fun of because he didn't speak right now gets paid ridiculous sums of money to travel the world to do what? He gets the biggest smile on his face. He's like, speak. I'm like, don't let anybody ever tell you what you can't do. Anything's possible. And so that's a very long answer to your short question about have I ever been terrified with speaking? I'll also give you another story related to your experience in divinity. I'm really a dork. I love the movie Chariots of Fire about two white guy runners from Britain in the 1920s. It's the most ridiculous movie that I watch like three or four times a year. And the reason I watch it is one of the runners, his name, it's based on a true story. One of them, his name is Eric Little, and he was a Christian missionary from Scotland. And his sister's been pressuring him. He should go back to work in the missions in China. And so they take this walk in Edinburgh, and he looks back at Edinburgh. He's like, wow, it's beautiful. I'm really going to miss it. And she looks at him. He's like, I've made my decision. You're right. I'm going to go back and work in the missions in China. And she gets all excited. He's like, but first I'm going to run in the Olympic Games. And she looks confused. He's like, Jenny, you have to understand something. God made me for a purpose, and that's the missions in China. But he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. Every time I hear that line, I have chills go through my spine because Kirsten, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's how I feel on stage. Sometimes I say something brilliant and I know I didn't say it. And that's what I love. It's like my favorite thing. Like it's happened several times throughout my life where I'm like, there's no way I was quick enough to think of that. Where did that just come from? I'm like, and it's really cool. So sidebar.
No, I was just thinking about flow and finding flow. And sometimes you can access, the divine, which I think flow is, you dip a toe into that river, or, maybe a whole foot if you're brave, and things happen that you don't quite expect. I'd love to ask, because you talked about being a journalist. So when you were a kid, what did you dream of becoming?
President of the United States. Now I'd like to be the ex-president of the United States. I think that's a much better job. Being president's not much fun. Working on Capitol Hill, I people ask, well, what was it like working on Capitol Hill? I'm like, well, in high school, I used to clean toilets. And if ever given a chance between working on Capitol Hill and cleaning toilets again, I'd much rather clean toilets. It's much more rewarding. There was a lot of nasty people on Capitol Hill. I don't like being around negative energy. I don't like being around people that put others down. And so I'm very intentional about my no jerk policy. And so that's why I love things like what you're, the reason I became a journalist was I wanted to be the next Charles Kuralt. I wanted to go around America doing all these great little stories about Ma and Pa stores and everything, because this country's great. And instead they put me on the political beat, which is all negative. And I was at a press conference with the president. He said nothing, Kirsten. And I looked at the lead six of my colleagues had written, and it was so negative and nasty. And I'm like, I know you can't be objective as a journalist because all of us bring our own experiences to things, but you can be fair. And I didn't like what I was seeing. And that's why I don't want that in my life. I want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. Anybody can gripe and be negative, and I just don't want to be around that. Life's too short, man. It's a real blessing, our time here. I want to make sure to maximize that time.
Absolutely. I've always said that it's easier to destroy and tear down versus build and collaborate and make things more beautiful or equitable or whatever that looks like. I, first of all, don't think I could have ever handled being on Capitol Hill. Just from the news cycle, you can see how angry or tense or stressed or unhappy or whatever that whole area looks like. So, So when you're a journalist, you don't get the choice, because I loved On the Road. I loved on the road. Because I grew up watching that show. So you don't get a choice. They just like send you where you go.
Well, it just depends on, I mean, you're low on the ladder. Where's nobody want to go? I mean, which I actually, I mean, I love journalism. I'm a very curious person. They put me on assignments. And I'm like, wow, this is interesting. But then I guess they liked what they saw when I was reporting on politicians. I mean, I have a pretty good strategy for getting people to talk. And the way you get people to talk is just act stupid. I mean, I'm not that stupid, but people would say things to me that they probably shouldn't because they didn't think that they would appear in print. I'm like, well, you just said it. I mean, I'm just reporting what you said. And so I was pretty good at that, but I don't like that. That's not why I became, I watch CBS Sunday Mornings, like the one positive show on television, and Steve Hartman, he has my dream job because that's what he does. He does all those great stories about the special needs kid that's put in the basketball game that hits 7 3-pointers in 4 minutes, or the lonely goose that finds the old man that like is in love with the old. I mean, I'm like, these are the greatest stories. I mean, how do you not love stories? Like, I mean, because you always hear all these negative things. I mean, I wanted to be the guy that is at the very end of the news, you know, because you watch 28 minutes of misery and they're like, and now here's Danny. You say, well, today, here's something cool that happened was this elderly guy was shopping and he had just lost his wife. And the camera caught this little 4-year-old girl just decided to give him a hug. And they're now the best of friends. I mean, I'm like, those are the stories that people need to hear those because there's just so much. I mean, when I wrote, so when I was a teacher, when I was a middle school teacher, I was the only teacher in my school that none of my students were ever tardy to class. And the reason was because I always started class with a Paul Harvey story. I don't know if you remember Paul Harvey, Kirsten, but I grew up listening to him on the radio. He'd come on at 12:15 every day. He'd be like, I'm Paul Harvey with the rest of the story. And for 5 minutes, he's describing a person or a place or a thing. You're trying to guess, what's he talking about? And my students, they absolutely love the stories. But the problem with Paul Harvey is his stories are primarily about like Fred Astaire and Sears Roebuck. Well, in the 21st century, no kid knows anything about that. So then I wrote, I'll say this for this podcast. So I wrote this book, Convicted, and this is 52 stories of famous people that were put in prison that found Christ while they were in prison. And I want this book to be, I'm trying to donate it to every prisoner on the planet so that they have something to read that inspires them. Because I want people to realize, it was the same thing I used to tell my little ones when I was a teacher. I'm like, you know, your story is still being written. Don't let one mistake define the rest of your life. You can still create, I'll get biblical here. I mean, look at Paul. Paul's like the greatest example ever. I'm like, he's just this anti-Christian jerk, you know, makes a martyr out of Stephen. And then he has his Damascus moment. And what's he do? He writes almost the entire New Testament. He's like the greatest. And it's like, wow, if he can do that, maybe I can do something like that. So I think people need more inspiring stories around. I mean, this is where you and I are like, we can talk for hours about this stuff is, just too much negativity in the world. There's a lot of positive things happen that people need to know about.
Yeah. Okay. Hello. I love Paul Harvey. Love him. I had forgotten that tagline, and here's the rest of the story. I loved Paul Harvey. We need to bring that back. I mean, I told someone one of my dreams is to travel around the U.S. and interview people and find out about their lives and the beauty they're creating and the goodness they're bringing into the world. So you and I are, we're on the same wavelength here, and I love it. Why do you think, and maybe this is self-evident, but I would like to hear it from your words. Why do you think story is so powerful and so needed?
Well, it's part of our DNA. I mean, even cave people, you know, they would tell stories of around the cave, you know, maybe the guy should have been paying attention when the other guy was saying, oh, don't eat those berries. Well, that it was a survival device. Of all people, it was Stalin who said 1 million dead is a statistic. One person dead is a tragedy. Translation, facts tell, but stories sell. Facts inform, but stories transform. And when I'm working with people about stories. People think that they have to be extraordinary to be on a stage. I'm like, I actually totally disagree with that. The fact that you're on the stage makes you extraordinary. I don't think you have to boast about yourself. And I don't think it's actually the way to be a better speaker in any way. I'm working with a gentleman, a very successful businessman in Saudi Arabia right now. And he's climbed the highest peak on all seven continents. He swam with sharks in Madagascar. He did the Iditarod in Alaska. And I look at him, I'm like, nobody can relate to you. Nobody in your audience has climbed Mount Everest. But I guarantee you, everybody in your audience peed their pants when they were 6 years old. That's a good story. That's a story that people are going to connect with. And that's what you're trying to do ultimately when you're on a stage, is what can I do to connect with my audience? And the way you do that is through storytelling. Here's an exercise you can do. It's one of the first exercises I have clients do, Kirsten. So later on, get in a comfortable chair with a pen and paper, libation of choice, and for an hour, write down every story that's ever happened to you. And I don't mean the entire story. I just mean triggers, like the time I locked myself out of the car in front of Costco, the time Dad spilled mustard on his tie when we were at that fancy restaurant. You'll find in an hour, you can come up with literally hundreds of stories like that. So that's the first part of the exercise. The second part of the exercise is then I want you to think about, what's a story really about? Oh, this is a story about never giving up. Oh, this is a story about your priorities. Oh, this is a story about love. And so on my computer, I have hundreds of files with literally tens of thousands of stories. So when I'm putting together a presentation and I want my audience to have a certain type of emotional reaction, I know exactly the story that I'm going to use. Now, I'm a little bit different than a lot of people out there coaching. A lot of people coach you to talk about the most traumatic moment of your life. And there's three reasons why I don't coach that way. First of all, the world just survived a global pandemic. Everybody's had a lot of bad stuff happen to them. I don't think we need more sad stories. I think we need more uplifting and positive stories. Second of all, what I'm coaching my clients to do is how to create what I call a well-crafted story. Politicians call it a stump speech. I've heard people call it a signature talk. You can call it peanut butter and jelly. It doesn't matter what you call it. What this is a presentation that you're going to deliver again and again to introduce yourself to new audiences. Well, do you really want to relive the worst moment of your life again and again? I mean, I have a friend, his daughter was killed in a school shooting. He's told that story over 1,000 times. I have no idea how he does it. He's got to be a lot stronger than me. I couldn't talk about the worst day of my life again and again. I'm trying to make people comfortable on stage. And then third, and this is where people get angry with me. My most basic fundamental objective when I'm on stage is I want you to leave feeling better than when you came in. I want you laughing, smiling, happy. I think there's something admirable about that as a basic objective. I believe the people that tell the same sad story again and again, by the 20th time they're telling it, now those are crocodile tears. And now they're being manipulative. And I'm not saying it's not an effective sales strategy. It's actually a very effective sales strategy. But I personally don't want to have to take a shower when I get off stage because I just manipulated my audience. There are ethical ways to get people to want to do business with you. And so I just think we need a lot more positivity. Plus, and I'll cite research on this. I saw the movie Monsters, Inc. And Monsters, Inc., which is the ultimate in research, basically said that laughter is more powerful than frightening people. And I believe in the power of laughter.
All I have to say is, preach, preach, because... That is 100% absolutely true. The other piece I just want to pull in is that, you know, science has shown that with epigenetics and trauma or experiences, those are stories basically, and they come down in our genetics, and we bestow them upon our, you know, the ones who come after us. So story is really powerful. It's what moves this world. And I think it's utterly astonishing. It can make or break entire worlds. I mean, I tell everyone that, you know, the simplest thing you can do every day is maybe someone you work with, maybe someone you encounter, you can say to them, oh my gosh, that lipstick looks amazing on you. That's the best color. And then, you know, they take that in and that changes their story about either their day or themselves, or that lipstick. I mean, who knows? But every day we have the opportunity to not only change our story, but maybe give some kindness and change someone else's story. And that is really, really powerful. I would love to ask you the second question, which is, did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like? And obviously we've talked about you, you're Christian, but did that ever evolve over time? Your understanding of your connection to the divine?
Yeah, I grew up, I grew up Catholic. And so religion for us, my Catholicism, my best memories were when I lived in Iowa, was during Lent on Friday nights. We got to go to Long John Silver's if we were lucky for fish. I was very happy about that. So that, and I like the Knights of Columbus used to give us Tootsie Rolls at church. That's what I remember about growing up Catholic. And then, and I actually used to go to church when I lived in Los Angeles. And then when they had the big Catholic priest scandal, the way the Los Angeles Archdiocese decided to handle it was they just transferred every priest to a different parish. And that's when I decided to start evaluating my faith and look, and I'm not putting down Catholicism. I love Pope Leo. This guy is great. And Pope Francis was awesome too. I'm like, this is great. And I've had all kinds of priests that were the greatest people in the world. I guess spiritually it's weird because like I've got so many friends that are Mormons and so many friends that are Jews. I don't know who's right. I know what's right. What's right is being, you already hit the word, kindness. How can I be kinder to people? I'll give you a story. Among my many pivots, one of my positions is I'm a visiting distinguished professor at the American University in Cairo. Say that five times fast. And so every time I go to Cairo, I always like to go speak to schools in the area to pump up the parents about how to get their kids excited about reading. And so they booked me in this school that was an Islamic school. And I got to tell you, I was intimidated. I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to connect. I'm a Christian. And so basically, Kirsten, it was a 2 o'clock training. 400 parents showed up. All the guys had long beards. All the women were in burqas. And we were talking like you and I are talking right now. And I'm like, man, shame on me. And so I tried out my first joke. I started off, I said, so I was reading this book the other day. Have any of you ever read the Quran? And they all laughed. I'm like, okay, good. That's good. And then I said, oh, well, then you know the story when the angel Gabriel appears in the cave to Muhammad. What's his first instruction to Muhammad? Because the first pillar of Islam is to read. And so I looked at the parents. I'm like, so not only should you be reading to your kids, it's actually written in your most sacred text that it's your duty to get your kids reading. And I had 400 heads going like this. I'm like, holy cow, who would have thought the Christian dude's favorite audiences are Muslims? I just think they're the greatest people on the planet. And I mean, my wife's from Singapore. Half of her family's Buddhist. I mean, you know, I'm in India all the time. I got Hindu audiences. And I'm like, when people use their religion as a weapon, I have a major problem with that. My goal is that my Christianity is a verb, not a noun, that people look at me and they're like, wow, he's kind. I'd like to know more about him. But I was very blessed, Kirsten. I mean, my parents were both at home, great people. I talk to people all the time that had horrible experiences as children, and I didn't. I had Mayberry. I grew up with, I'll give you a story. When I stopped teaching, I was at a party and my mom was talking to my old high school English teacher and they didn't know I was eavesdropping on their conversation. And my high school English teacher mentioned to my mom, she said, oh, I'm so sad that Danny's going to stop being a teacher. He was such a good teacher. And my mom said, but Danny's good at everything. Well, that's the world I grew up in. I was in a world where people encourage me. I've been blessed my entire life, Kirsten, with great parents, great siblings, great kids, great spouse, great teachers, great mentors. I know a lot of people don't get that. And so, and when I taught in the hood, I saw it and it became a real important responsibility to me is showing kids, hey, you matter. You can like, don't let the negative, you know, J.K. Rowling talks about it in Harry Potter. Don't let the muggles get you down. There's people that put you down all the time. And what I liked, you said, it takes just as much effort to say something kind to a person as it does to say something rude and negative. Why not focus on the kind? I mean, and the negative. When I was a teacher, I used to have a spray bottle with water. And whenever somebody said something negative, I used to spray them. I'm like, get away. I don't want that to spread. I got to make sure to get rid of that. I'd probably get sued today doing, I'm sure I'd get sued today doing that, spraying kids with water. That's harassment. Whatever. The teachers don't have it easy. I can tell you that.
That is absolutely true. And I live in the desert Southwest, so I would welcome that spray of water.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Very grateful for that. But yeah, teachers, that's a whole other conversation. I think it is one of the most challenging vocations on the planet simply because, well, I mean, even more challenging now, right? With the phones and the internet and all of that. But, you know, depending on, even in the 80s, when I was in high school, I looked around and I thought, I could never teach. These kids are bonkers. I just don't have the, I don't know if it's patience or, actually, they were very intimidating. And I just didn't, any high school teacher I met, I thought, I just don't know how you do it. It's, you're incredible. But I also so appreciate your story about going to Cairo and, because I grew up for 4 years in Pakistan. So that part of the world is very, you know, special and close to my heart and the people over there as well. And it's just, I just kind of love that image of you. You're like, I'm going to, you know, start off and break the ice with this. And everybody laughed and they got it and they understood it. And talk about humor, creating connection. Always what we were talking about, laughter, creating connection. And the people that I've always resonated with and that I've appreciated deeply are those that can find the humor, can bring the funny, and help me to understand that maybe we don't have to take everything so seriously. There is a time for that, but I think laughter is an incredible, incredible gift to give to people.
Oh yeah. I mean, when I taught kindergarten, they taught me, I'll take my job seriously. I won't take myself too seriously because I ain't all that. Neither are you. And if you think you're all that, teach kindergarten for a week. I had a little girl, LaShonda, raised her hand one day. I'm like, LaShonda, question. She's like, Miss Bissell, when are you going to trim your nose hair? I'm like, this afternoon. Thanks for bringing that to my attention, LaShonda. I ain't all that. And they just cracked me up.
Oh, my God.
Great.
Yeah. No filter. No filter.
No filter. Which,
you know what? Sometimes that's good. It's a good thing. You know, I have to say that you have written some really interesting and, for me, provocative books. Provocative in a way that, you know, when you tell someone about them, I'm intrigued. I want to know more. Did you ever, think to yourself, because writing is, well, I guess I could ask you this. Do you think writing is different than speaking? Was it scary to consider, hey, I'm going to write a book and put it out into the world? Or did it just feel like fated, like something you were supposed to do?
Well, for me, writing and speaking are totally linked together. They're just who I am. I love telling stories. I mean, the reason when I wrote Misfits and Crackpots, one of my favorite stories in that book was there was two women. They were both choreographers in New York City. One was named Martha. The other one was named Agnes. And Agnes has just opened her third show on Broadway. And audiences seem to like it, but the critics have just panned it. And she looks at Martha. She's like, I give up. I think I'm just going to close down the show. And Martha looks at her. She's like, you can't do that. It's not for some critic to tell you how good your work is. It's not even for you to say how good your work is. But you have to understand this, Agnes. There's only one you. There's never been another you. There's never going to be another you. And if you close down this show, you are denying your gift for the world. Well, Martha was Martha Graham, who's considered the mother of modern dance. She won the Kennedy Center Honors Presidential Medal of Freedom. Agnes was Agnes DeMille. She won the same honors. She became the first woman to have three concurrent hit musicals on Broadway. She kept the show open, but she changed the name to Oklahoma. I want people to hear stories like that. And I love telling stories like that. And then I can tell, like when I'm working with business people. Again, I like humorous stories. I like stories from your childhood because childhood stories allow you to make lots of mistakes and show that you, I mean, I think everybody has to be vulnerable some, but it's a lot more, it's trickier to pull off being vulnerable about something that happened last year as opposed to when you were 6 years old or whatever. I mean, one of my clients yesterday was asking me, he's like, well, what do you do? I'm like, well, all right, so I'll give you an example. I'm like, I've learned the stupidest thing I ever said to a group of kids was one day I told my first graders, I'm like, all right, kids, write about your lives. And they looked at me like I was from outer space. They're like, we're only six. Nothing's happened to us. I'm like, no, man, things happen to you all the time. I'm like, when I was 6 years old, I was in a class one day and my teacher, she called me stupid and she smacked me on the hand and got me to cry in front of the whole class. And so the next day I was walking to school. I had an apple and I peed on the apple and I gave her the apple and she ate the apple and said, that was the best apple I ever had. My little ones are like, that is awesome. You know, this is also the reason I never accept food from a child. But I learned if you want other people to tell you stories, you got to tell them stories. And so that's the point, you know, in one of my speeches when I'm trying to get people to sign up for my my speaker coaching, I say, you know, when I was an elementary school teacher, every other teacher at the school went through hundreds, if not thousands of Band-Aids every single school year. I mean, kids love Band-Aids. They work better than smokes on the prison yard. Well, every year I went through exactly one Band-Aid. And my colleagues always ask me, what's your secret? I'm like, well, on the first day of school, I always have some chubby little boy in my class picking at a scab all morning long. And finally has success after lunch, starts bleeding. And the annoying little girl next to him raises her hand, rubs her nose and says, Miss Purcell, Paco is bleeding. I'm like, oh, my goodness, Paco, you know what you need? You need a Band-Aid. Now, 33 little heads look at me. I'm like, I got a drawer full of Band-Aids in my desk, and I don't have just ordinary Band-Aids. I got Mighty Morphin Power Ranger Band-Aids, and I'm going to give you the Green Ranger because he's the coolest. Now, Paco's smiling. All the kids are grinning. I take Paco to my desk. I say, oh, before I put on the Band-Aid, we got to clean out the wound. So I take out the bottle of rubbing alcohol, show that to all the kids. I'm like, Paco, hold on to my hand. This might sting a little bit. Start pouring it on. Ah, there you go. Anybody else need a Band-Aid? My students can have a skull fracture and they will never ask me for a Band-Aid. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to give you Band-Aids today. I'm going to give you practical strategies on how to create a well-crafted presentation that turns your audience into clients. So I've taken a silly story to make a teaching point. And that's the difference I tell people between a good presentation and a great presentation. Good presenters, they tell stories. Great presenters tell stories with intention that are taking you to an outcome that they desire that'll help both of you. So
yeah,
that's how I do it. Long answers to your short questions, Kirsten.
I'm just listening to you and learning, and that's my favorite. I did want to just tell you that I dated a Catholic gentleman for 5 years and I lived in Portland, Oregon, and we would go to the Archdiocese in Portland. It was the most beautiful church I've ever seen. The head priest there was a White Sox fan from Chicago, which was pretty upsetting for me because I will be Cubs all the way forever. But my favorite priest was a Jesuit, and I really appreciated him because I've loved science since I was a kid. So I like to hear sermons that are intellectually, you know, invigorating. But one of the things that I loved the most and appreciated most that I learned, the Catholic faith has this idea or concept of charism. And it's the gifts that you are born with when, you know, you come into this world. And it is your job as a human being to discover your charisms and then live into them, to give gifts to other people and lift other people up. And so I guess my question is, was it easy for you to discover your charisms? You know, I know you said you've never met a microphone that you didn't like, but, you know, it's for some people, it can take them 40 years to discover what they're good at. you just seem to be on this really accelerated track, frankly. I mean, I don't know. Was it challenging for you? And then the idea of bringing them into the world, it sounds like it was easy for you.
I don't know if it was easy, Kirsten, but it is something I was asked that the other day. What's your superpower? And I thought about it. I guess my superpower this was actually my men's Bible study we were asking about. That's where it was. I was trying to think. You know, the guys are like, what's your superpower, Danny? And I'm like, I think my superpower is I'm just really good at encouraging people. I get people to believe in things that they don't believe in them. I used to say that to the students all the time. Like, you know, sometimes you need somebody else to believe in you before you believe in yourself. I believe in all of you. They only give me the best and the brightest. So let's go out and make this world a better place. There's phrases I say every day to the kids because I want them sticking in their heads all the time. Because again, my parents encouraged me all the time. When my students used to leave my classroom for the day, whether it was my little ones or my older ones, they always had to hear the same refrain. I said, remember, kids, education is valuable, but execution is priceless. Knowledge is not power. Only applied knowledge is power. Knowing what the right thing to do and doing the right thing are two very different things. So let's go out, do the right thing, and make this world a better place. I mean, the kids had to hear that every single day, but I want it to be in their heads. I want that ringing in their heads constantly. Because I have little mantras like that. I mean, one of my favorite speakers of all time is the UCLA basketball coach, John Wooden. One of the things that he did in his speeches, which I always thought was remarkable, was he cited poems from memory. And so because of him, I've made sure to memorize certain poems just because I just thought, wow, that's a really cool skill to have. One of my favorite poems he said was, no written word nor spoken plea can teach our youth what they should be, nor all the books on all the shelves. It's what the teachers are themselves. I love that one. The one I give to entrepreneurs was by James Albury, where it's like, I love it. He says, he dined beneath the moon, he basked beneath the sun, he lived a life of going to do and died with nothing done. I just love that. I love little poems like that.
Oh my God.
That was a great, I love watching speakers and working with people. I was at an event and it was all these famous athletes. I'm not going to name all the famous people there, but the last two were Mary Lou Retton and Peter Vidmark, who both won gold medals in the 1984 Summer Olympics in gymnastics. And at the end of their presentation, they do these backflips. And I was like, oh, I got to learn how to do a backflip. That's the coolest ending ever. There's a guy, I watched him do his presentation. This is actually one of the coolest things I'd ever seen. So he's an artist. And the entire time he's working on this painting while he's speaking, and you don't know what the painting is. And then at the end of the presentation, he turns the painting upside down. And it's like of a famous person, like, oh my gosh, he was painting Einstein, or you just didn't see it the entire time. I was like, wow, that's really cool. That's a cool thing. So I'm always looking for what's the thing I can do in a presentation to make me memorable. Now I'm just going, I'm off the rail. You got me off the rails. Now I'm just rambling. So you can redirect me, Kirsten.
Oh my gosh. I appreciate the off the rails thing because it makes things more interesting and surprising. I'm a fan of that. I'd love to ask the main question, which is, I would so appreciate if you could share one story or two stories where you feel like you've either witnessed or experienced something magical, miraculous, or mysterious.
Well, I'll give you two experiences. One's me and one's my wife. So I went to this thing called Boy State when I was a junior, and we were just there. I was there with two buddies and we just wanted to party. We showed up in tank tops and shorts, and all of a sudden we saw that there's guys in suits. So I'm like, man, maybe we should have read the flyer. Yeah. So Boy State's basically to brainwash you about American politics for a week. There's worse things to be brainwashed about. It was great. And so we were each put in a city. There's 25 people in a city, and then they'd have four cities would make a county, which was 100. And then there was four counties total. So the entire Boy State was 400 of us. And the one rule was everybody had to run for some office. And so The very first day I ran for mayor of my city, I said, I'm making you one campaign promise. Vote for me for mayor and I'll never run for anything again. We're just required to. I'm just here to screw around. And so I got elected mayor and I was like, oh, that's cool. I'm done. And then they all said, you should run for county commissioner. I'm like, I only made one promise. That was that I'm not going to run again. I can't break the promise. And they're like, no, we want you to run. I'm like, oh, okay. So I run for county commissioner. I get elected county commissioner. Well, then the next thing is you can either run for governor or for U.S. senator. And I didn't care about any of this, but U.S. senator, they said it's a free, all expense paid trip to Washington, D.C. I'm like, really? Oh, I got to do that. And so I decided I was going to run for U.S. senator. And there was about 40 guys that ran for U.S. senator. And I made it down to the final four. And so what they did is they made the final four. They put you in groups of in pairs, and you had to go in front of each county, and the county would ask you questions, and it was like a debate, and you had to answer the questions. It was really interesting because the night before the debate, all the guys from my city, they briefed me on different issues that I might be asked. And it was, I was like, oh, it's kind of like what the president does, is you get all these briefings. And so the guy that I was paired with was like the national speech and debate champion. I'm like, oh, so he's like really good. And so the very first county we went to was his county. And this guy was a jerk. And I lost it and called him a word I probably shouldn't have called him in front of everybody. But then the second county was my county, and my county had my back, and they made it tough. So I'm like, okay, we're one for one. And then the third county was actually really good. I was like, wow, they asked really good questions. And I thought I held my own. But then the fourth county was where my two buddies were in. And it was just a screw around county. They were asking all these weird questions. So they asked us each to tell a joke. And my opponent told the worst joke ever. And I told this joke, which I'm not proud that I told the joke I did. But even the Legionnaires were laughing at the joke. I'm just looking at these old men like, oh, that's an American boy telling a dirty joke like that. Like, it's like a horrible, I would never tell that joke today. But then, so to the point, Danny, get to the point. Okay, so the point was, they asked a question. The very final question was, if you could be any ice cream, what would you be? And the other guy got to answer first, and he took my answer. He said, I'd be Neapolitan, because as your senator, I would represent all of your views, just like Neapolitan has different views. And it's exactly what I was thinking. It comes to me, and this is the religious moment, the spiritual moment. I have no answer. And I say, bubblegum. And they're like, why would you be a bubblegum ice cream? I'm like, because it's a little bit outrageous and you can always blow it. And everybody laughs hysterically. And I'm like, I didn't say that. That came from God. It sounds like a silly story, but it's literally this moment where I'm like, God, and I won. I got to go to Boys Nation, was what it was called. All expense paid trip to Washington, D.C. changed my life. But that was my moment where, I mean, it's cool. It's cool because I'm like, man, it's such an insignificant thing for God, but he cared about me. It was amazing to me. So that's my moment. My wife, we were in church one day because my wife's always been a Christian. The pastor, he's giving his sermon, and my wife turns to me and she's like, wouldn't it be great if Jesus told you he loved you? This has nothing to do with the sermon whatsoever, Kirsten. My wife's never paying attention. And I'm like, yeah, honey, pay attention to what he's saying. This is ridiculous. You just, like, nothing. So we go to pick up the kids from, I don't know what they call it. Like the kids are being taken care of and they're preaching to them. I don't know what they call it. Children's ministry. That's what children's ministry. What an articulate person I am. Yeah. So we go to the children's ministry to pick up my oldest daughter. And the teacher, she puts her hand on my wife's arm. She's like, this is going to sound crazy, Jeannie, but Jesus told me to tell you he loves you. This is a half an hour since. I'm like, what the heck? I'm like, that is unbelievable. I mean, I'm sorry. I get goosebumps every time I tell this story because I'm like, what was that all of? I can't believe that. And I'm like, that's lame, man. My wife, she's got like a direct line to God, man. That's pretty amazing. But those are two moments. But then, I mean, there's all the other moments. You know, I told my men's Bible study once, I said, sometimes I'm actually grateful for the bad things to happen to me because I find I really pay a lot more attention to God when bad things are happening to me, and I don't pay as much attention when the good things are happening. Maybe that's a reminder I need to always kind of keep God forefront. And I'm not trying to preach to anybody. I'm just telling you my own experiences. I've been very blessed. But then the other thing that God gave me is besides being encouraging to others, I've always had a Pollyanna attitude. Like I can always, a friend of mine, a very good friend, we have a shared friend who got a bad disease. And he told my other friend, he said, oh, I don't know what to do about this disease. And my friend Dave says, call Danny, because Danny will convince you not only is it good that you have the disease, but it's probably the best thing ever to happen to you. I'm like, yeah, that is kind of my personality, is anytime there's a bad thing, I'm able to put the good spin on it. You know, so those are my encounters with God. But I mean, God's there all the time for me. And it's kind of cool realizing, I'm like, man, I mean, I just look at everything God had to do to get my wife and me together. I'm like, wow, it's like an impossible match. How did that happen? That's like Rubik's Cube kind of stuff. And it worked out. And yeah, I've been very blessed, Kirsten. I'm very humbled.
I was just going to, my follow-up question was going to be, because I do think encouraging people and lifting them up and being the positive, optimistic force in the room or indeed the city or what have you, it can be exhausting, but if there is a well that you can, you know, use to energize yourself or, you know, you can be a huge blessing for everyone around you. Such a gift, because it is easy to fall into that negative mindset. It is easy to kind of tumble down that slope of feeling bad or being depressed or feeling hopeless or what have you. When you have someone who has your back and is right there saying, no, you can handle this. No, you were born for this or whatever. It can change people's lives, you know, change their story. So, you know, my final question is, I know you're humble. I know you are so humble, but do you ever get drunk with power?
Drunk with power. When I was younger, I would say like, I needed, the real estate scam really was a great thing to happen to me, Kirsten. It really humbled me because it made me have to ask a lot of other people for help. That was a very important, it was very sobering to me. I'm a big believer in that you see the world the way you want to see it. It's kind of like when I read the Bible, I read the Bible differently than I'm laughing half the time I read the Bible, because if you read the Bible, to me, Jesus is the most frustrated teacher in history. He's got 12 dense dudes around him. He's like, all right, let me tell you a story. And I always tell people, I'm like, I bet you 9 out of 10 non-Christians are familiar with the story of the prodigal son. They're familiar with the story of the Good Samaritan. They're familiar with the story of David and Goliath. But I also bet you 9 out of 10 Christians cannot tell you the Ten Commandments. And the reason is it wasn't presented as a story. It was presented as a PowerPoint slide with 10 bullet points for you to memorize. And that's what illustrates to me the power of storytelling, is this is how you get the less. I mean, I think we're all kind of morons to ignore the children's stories. The nursery rhymes, the Aesop's fables, those things teach you a lot of important things when you read into them. And it's those stories. I mean, everybody knows the story of the tortoise and the hare. That's an important story. If you actually look at the moral to the story, that's what I'm always looking at. What's the moral to the story? And I know I'm drift. Just call me Driftwood. You ask me a question, then I go off on this whole other. I'm like, I must be the worst interviewee you've ever had, Kirsten. Like, man, where is he going with this stuff? But what was the original question? The original question was,
do you ever get drunk with power?
Oh, drunk. Oh, yeah. Drunk with power. So I'm like nowhere near that. Drunk with power. When I was younger, I thought I was all that. And the older I get, the more I realize I don't know that much. Matter of fact, my favorite post-it that I have on my desk that I read all the time is just a question to myself. What if I'm wrong? You know, everybody seems to be so sure of themselves all the time. Oh, my political view, it's absolutely right. I'm like, what if you're wrong? Or I believe, and, you know, they talk about it in Men in Black. You know, he says, what's he say? He says, 1800 years ago, we knew that the world, that the sun revolved around the earth. 500 years ago, we knew that the earth was flat. You know, 5 minutes ago, you knew that aliens didn't exist. What do we know? And I'm like, that's exactly right. Is there is a process. Like there's things that, I mean, the bad part about it is like, as I get older, it turns out like all my idols growing up turned out to be scumbags. I mean, like I idolized Bill Cosby growing up and now I'm like, ugh, that's not a good one. But then there's also a lot of people that you like, you thought they weren't that great. And then you look at it and you're like, oh, that person actually turned out to be really good. So, you can look at it the positive way too. It's an interesting journey. I'm very grateful for the journey. Drunk with power, though? No. I don't get drunk with power because I know you can lose it real quick. So the real estate. So again, taking a bad moment and realizing that was such an important lesson. I don't ever want to forget that lesson. I don't think I forget that lesson either.
Danny, I love that because I think what you're saying in this last little bit is that we can always change our story. Always, always.
Always. I mean, again, there's just so many examples in history. Like, it's ridiculous. My wife hates that I love sports so much. She's like, why do you watch sports all the time? I'm like, because at any given moment, something incredible can happen. I was watching a hockey game the other night and this hockey player, he had played this team like a month ago and injured their best player. And the other team, they were furious and they wanted to get at him. And he admitted in an interview, he's like, you know what? I didn't mean to hurt him that bad. They should be angry with me. And the very beginning of the hockey game, the other team, their enforcer throws off his gloves and starts punching the heck out of this guy. And the guy never threw a punch back. He's like, yeah, I deserved it. I was like, wow, I'm not even that big of a hockey fan. I'm like, wow, that's something rare. As a person, like Americans just won't ever accept responsibility for their mistakes at all. I'm like, I like that. That showed me a lot about the guy's character. I mean, I don't even know anything about him. I just know, I'm like, wow, he didn't hit back because he's like, you know, I deserve this. I think that all of us have to pay attention to that. This is why I watch sports. It's just amazing stories. This is why I love the Olympics. It drives my wife crazy. I always root against America. She's like, why are you rooting against America? I'm like, honey, who am I going to root for? The American with the microchip and his brand new Nikes or the barefoot Sudanese refugee who just survived a civil war. And they just did a background story. Of course I'm rooting. He's like, I learned how to run running away from the bullets in my village. I'm like, of course I'm rooting for that guy. The guy's the most amazing person ever. And you see things like that. And I mean, it's not just in sports too. You see it like when I was listening to an interview with Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx. And she's like the most inspiring story, how she created Spanx and her trials and tribulations. And I love that. I like people to know the story behind the story. Like before this person was up here, and I say this to all my clients all the time, before you're ever an expert, you're always an amateur. I mean, everybody freaks out about first grade because it's not like kindergarten. But after a little while, you get used to first grade. You know, you can be the best college basketball player in America, but when you make it into the NBA, at first, you don't feel like you belong there. Like, oh, these are the pros. I guarantee you, every occupant of the Oval Office, the first day they step into the White House, they don't feel like they belong there. And then they grow into the role. Same thing with all of us. And hopefully you're paying attention to the lessons along the way. That's the big mistake a lot of people make is they don't learn. And that is unforgivable when you keep on making the same mistake again and again. So hopefully I don't make the same mistakes. I learn from my mistakes and I become a better person for them. And I then my duty is, once I've learned from the mistake, is to help other people so that they don't make that same mistake. That's where I see my role.
Y'all enjoyed this episode and just how funny Dr. Danny is. I mean, I feel like there is a reason he's been on so many stages, and it's because he's captivating, confident, and has an incredible sense of humor. If you want to check him out and the other stuff that he's doing in the world, all the magic that he's creating, well, look at the episode's show notes. There will be lots of links for you to check out and figure out what kind of magic and mystery and mayhem this man is creating in the world. I want to thank each and every one of you for listening. It means so much. And it's a lot of work, but I love it. And then the fact that you guys listen too makes me really happy. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Dr. Danny. Honestly, go change the world with a story. I mean, that's what he's doing. He's taking events from his life and finding ways to shift and change other people's worlds through his own experiences. And I know each and every one of you has had experiences or events that have changed your lives, and you never know when you're gonna bump into somebody who needs to hear your particular brand of truth. So be like Dr. Danny and always have a story in the wings that you can share with someone else to inspire them, to educate them, to give them a little hope. Never forget that stories run this world. And you, my friend, have hundreds, if not thousands, of stories to tell. And I can't wait to hear them. I can't wait to hear them. Thanks again for listening, everyone. And see you next time for the very next episode of the podcast.